IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to this episode of All Things Policy. Today I have with me my colleague Manoj, and we are going to be discussing the property crisis that has been ailing China for quite a few years now. It was embodied by the collapse of Evergrande back in 2021, which really made like global headlines because the group was one of the biggest real estate players in China by 2018, but by 2021 was in financial collapse. So we're going to try and understand today, why is this collapse so important to China? Or what is the importance of the property sector in China? What is the government trying to do to rectify the challenges that it is facing? And, you know, just what is the situation when it comes to property sector in China? So welcome, Manoj.
Thank you so much, Ambavi.
So tell us a bit about what is happening. So Evergrande has been asked to go into liquidation. What does that mean?
So this is, you know, whenever somebody uses the phrase or the word collapse for Evergrande and the Chinese property sector, it seems like a misnomer because every time I think of what's happening in the property sector and with Evergrande, it sort of sounds like, you know, the climax of a really bad movie in which everything is taking place in slow motion, super slow motion. So you can't really call it a collapse because it is so slow in which the process is happening. The idea of a collapse seems sudden, rapid, quick, but none of that is really happening in this case, right? Even this liquidation order that you mentioned, which has come from a Hong Kong court, has come after quite a few years of, you know, Evergrande making commitments, not being able to fulfill them, and, you know, lots of back and forth. But in briefly, you know, what's happened with this liquidation order is that basically Evergrande has debts worth roughly around $300 billion. A lot of that is owed to foreign investors. Those people have been trying to recover that money. And therefore, eventually, the Hong Kong court said that, look, you must pay back your debts and therefore you must liquidate. Now, in theory, that sounds great. That's how market principles and rule of law should work. The challenge is that to be able to liquidate Evergrande, you need to have access to its assets in the mainland. Now, as much as this is, you know, interesting, the challenge is that, look, there is no precedent to Hong Kong court rulings of this nature being applied to the mainland. There is possibility that, you know, because of certain kinds of connects that have been built between Shenzhen and Hong Kong, that it can apply, but it is really, really unlikely that this liquidation order will get effectively implemented. And we've seen that over the past month or so since the order has been passed, right? There has been very little movement. And now we're hearing about the potential for suits against the auditors of Evergrande. And that's just simply because the order from Hong Kong will not be implemented in the mainland. Because for it to be implemented in mainland, Beijing has to agree that it will prioritize the liquidation of Evergrande's assets to pay off a significant chunk of foreign investors. For it to agree to do that, if it agrees to do that, it will essentially antagonize a whole lot of people within the mainland who may be investors, who may be contractors, who may be suppliers, who may be home buyers, who are waiting for their dues. And those are obviously the priorities of the Chinese government in the mainland. So it's really unlikely that any of this will actually get implemented. But it does send a jolt across the ecosystem of property developers in China, particularly those who are listed in Hong Kong, so the big players. And it tells them that, look, the days of free riding, the days of easy money are over. So to that extent, it is a valuable outcome, but it's unlikely to have any material impact on the overall property market crisis that China has been dealing with for the last few years in particular.
And I guess to a certain extent also signals the gravity of the problem, right? Because this is not only about the crisis is not about Evergrande only. it is a part of the ecosystem the way it has been developed.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and it's like, this is one of those, you know, open secrets that this is a, like I said, that's why the word collapse seems so inappropriate, because it's such a slow moving, long process of a disease, which where everybody knows what the root causes of this disease are. Everybody has identified the symptoms, and a lot of the work in the last 7, 8, 9 years has been essentially about sort of doing, you know, some sort of symptomatic treatment as opposed to addressing the root causes. And now in the last few years, as the government has sort of tried to address some of the root causes of this ailment, it's only worsening the situation, at least for the near term, or rather I'd put it as in a way that unless you further sort of fall down, unless it further worsens the situation, you're not really going to recover. So the bottom has to still hit. And in that sense, yes, it does, you know, tell you a little bit about the fact that this is just one, you know, lots of talk has been about Evergrande, but this is just one of many developers who are in deep distress in China. And if they don't eventually address this problem, or soon enough, you'll end up in a position where there will be more such cases, because now that the precedent has been set, you might actually see more such cases of listed major developers, which can then create, have a sort of knock-on effect on foreign investment in the country, investor confidence in the country, which anyway is sort of declining ever since the zero COVID business and this geopolitical rivalry with the US intensified.
Right. And I want you to go into the root causes, but before that, just how much of an impact would this ruling have on the global public image of China? And would that kind of spur some kind of moment for them to fix the root causes?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the fixing of the root causes is a... I don't think that they're looking at external sources of anxiety to try and address the root causes. I think the government has started to sort of look at and trying to address these root causes for the past 3-4 years. Mm-hmm. But that is driven by internal factors as opposed to external factors. I think that investor confidence, particularly foreign investor confidence in China, has remained weak for the last few years. I mean, data will tell you that during the pandemic, FDI into China increased significantly. But that was for various other reasons. There was lots of previous commitment and so on and so forth. I think what you're seeing now is that foreign investment in China is starting to decline. It is still significant, but it is starting to decline, and it will continue to remain weak. But that is owing to many other reasons other than just this property market situation. And I don't think that is what Beijing is looking at when it's looking to address this property market crisis. The one thing that I will say is that if there is no adequate resolution to this liquidation order given by the Hong Kong court, it can potentially signal to foreign investors that even though the law may be on your side, the politics will not be on your side. And therefore, if you've sunk your money, you're likely to be stuck regardless of what the law says. And that can hurt foreign investor confidence.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, can you just tell us about the root causes of why are we seeing the situation today?
Right, so, I mean, it depends on how far we go back, right? I mean, I can go back to the 2007-2008 great financial crisis. Everybody remembers that when the Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and all that happened, you know, and when George Bush's administration was exiting, you had this big stimulus package in America of $700+ billion, which was announced. People remember that stimulus package, which came into effect under Obama's administration. But simultaneously, there was a big $500+ billion stimulus package that the Chinese government also issued for the Chinese economy, which most people don't remember. And a lot of that money essentially went as investment into construction and properties, because you wanted to generate GDP. You pumped in all this cash, it created activity for local government officials in China. GDP was the metric on the basis of which their political progress was assessed. So therefore, they took that money and you ended up creating these vast towns, townships, you know, complexes, which not necessarily anybody was inhabiting. So what you created was lots of assets using that investment, which was non-productive. And a lot of them, and at the end of the day, those asset values kept going up because Chinese household wealth kept getting invested in property markets. You know, just like when we have money, we'll think of which are the safe places to invest. And the property market seemed like a safe bet because there was lots of easy money sloshing around and prices would continue to rise. So from the individual retail investor's perspective, it was a great bet. So increasingly, people also kept investing their money in the property sector. At one point of time, you reached a place where the investment for, you know, the incentive for investing in the property sector was so perverse because you're not creating any productive assets, but it's garnering all the money. Now, as the economy started to slow down, because you had this massive inventory, you know, that you could house the entire country maybe three times over and still have stock left over, you end up in a case in situations of speculation, which lead to other kinds of challenges in the economy. So at this point of time, the government is starting to think of how do we address this problem, because the property sector is unproductive, but it's monopolizing capital. At the same end, it's leading to risk. So how do we sort of address this problem? So in 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, the Xi Jinping administration announced what it called were three red lines. This basically set benchmarks for property developers, which they had to cross. There were certain thresholds of their with regard to their balance sheets and their debt to equity ratio and so on and so forth. Only satisfying which would they be able to access credit. So it limited the ability of these guys to raise credit. So it limited, therefore, placed essentially restrictions on banks to be able to fund this, which essentially meant that even local governments could not incentivize banks to fund this. And all of this is linked to the political economy of China, where local government officials are linked to local banks, which are then linked to certain kinds of property development countries. So it's a deep web of corruption also. So they started to do this. And immediately what you saw was that there was a slumping of the property sector because the easy money that was expected no longer was available. So that, I would say, is the root cause of this crisis. So in essence, it is the current crisis is a product of government policy to try and tame the property sector, to try and tame capital flow into the property sector and divert capital flow into areas where the government sees are key drivers for future economic growth. So high-end manufacturing in particular, technology, innovation, so on and so forth. And just an example of that, after which I'll end. I mean, last year, Bloomberg did an interesting report in which they had a chart and the graphic sort of showed data till only September. And it's quite a stark graphic. It just shows you how from March 2020 till September 2023, property sector investment and lending is declining. It's in a secular decline. It goes from being in positive territory to negative territory, whereas manufacturing sector investment and lending is continuously sort of rising. So this is, the shift that the Chinese economy is trying to make and is being driven by the government. And a byproduct of that is that the property sector is suffering.
Right. When you talk about governments, is this only like the central government or is the state governments also playing a role in regulations regarding sale and lending?
So no, this is essentially how the system works in China is that you've got the central leadership and the central government, which is issuing policy directives. And increasingly under Xi Jinping, it's the local governments that are implementing these policy directives. So, and they are given guidelines. So they're given from guidelines to clear directives and they must implement this. So the three red lines were strict directives, which the entire banking system must follow, which impacts, therefore, local governments have very little discretionary power in that. Now, what they can do is, of course, they can work with enterprises to fudge the data so that certain kinds of companies meet the guidelines. But then you have again, central control in terms of supervision, inspections, and so on and so forth, which if you're caught, obviously, you're politically ruined. It works like that, where the central government essentially, and this is increasingly under Xi Jinping because he's tightened controls from the top, is giving the guidelines, is sometimes making these rules, and local governments have to abide by them or find ways to adapt as much as possible. So that's how it works. So provincial and city government flexibility has shrunk significantly in the last 10 years.
Okay.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
So, okay, now the crisis is here. You said that there have been steps being made to kind of rectify the issues that were caused. Can you elaborate a bit more on what those are?
Yeah, I mean, for the last year and a half, we've been hearing, lots of talk about, that this is government is doing this strategically, we are thinking this through, and we've got to sort of boost certain degree of confidence, particularly as the economy has slumped through COVID and since even after the recovery from the zero COVID policy. There's been talk about, well, okay, we don't want to go back to the ways of the past. We know that there is this moral hazard that persists in the system. And I'll give you some data as to why the moral hazard persists in the system. So, you know, roughly 25 to 30% of the Chinese economy, Chinese GDP sort of is a product of the property sector. So it's a significant sector, right? So while it's slowing down, it impacts the overall economy. Roughly 70% of Chinese household wealth is placed within the real estate sector. So as prices start to shrink, it impacts people's wealth. As it impacts people's wealth, particularly during the COVID era, where employment was also dicey, it impacted spending and the economy sort of hit a deflationary trend. So you've got these structural issues with this market. So you have to eventually address it. But how do you do that without going back to the moral hazard of the past where you, because you know the government will have to address it because it can lead to social stability issues, people continue to borrow and people continue to make bad bets. So the government started doing certain things where it allowed certain local banks to go bankrupt. This happened a few years ago during the pandemic in 2020, which was signaling to the banking system that we will, not be shy of letting you fail. And if there are consequences of that, we'll try and deal with that. Then over the past year and a half, you saw massive protests where home buyers were protesting that, look, we've not gotten our properties. Vendors and contractors of property developers were protesting, saying we've not got our payments. So the government said, okay, look, our priority is going to be to try and address you guys and your problems. So it started focusing money more in directions of, can we support rental housing and can we make incentivize developers to, shift their whatever they've constructed or new constructions towards rental housing? Can we, let prices fall a little bit, although very carefully. So it's not really market driven, so that people can, get affordable housing and cheaper housing. Can government procure to get cheaper housing? And can we sort of upgrade old neighborhoods, ramshackle neighborhoods, so that property developers and people get projects to complete so that they can generate revenue and then they can actually complete what they've committed in the past, but they've not finished. So these were some steps. But this was not sufficient, right? This was, again, patchwork. So then late last year, they talked about building this new system, for real estate management. And what that meant was very, very unclear. In January this year, we understood what that meant. What that meant was the creation of a white list of projects. So these are all incomplete projects, which local governments were told that you must work with developers to find and identify based on certain parameters. I'm not sure what the parameters are, but based on certain parameters, what are the most viable projects that are currently stuck that need to be completed? And those projects you will sanction and you will send to banks. Banks must conduct their own assessments on the viability of those projects, but essentially banks should be lending to them because those are vetted by local governments. So this sort of whitelist project system came into place in mid to late January when they announced it. Just a bit of data on what has happened so far in that. Latest information tells us that around $17.2 billion worth of liquidity has been sanctioned under this by different banks across the country. And some 5,000 odd projects as a whole, if I'm correct, have been whitelisted. As a whole, it's not necessary that all those 5,000 have received funding, but those many, at least, I mean, Bloomberg's assessments tell us that there are at least those many, Reuters and Bloomberg's assessments tell us that around those many at least have been clarified. And this is across some 200 odd cities in the country. So that's how they're trying to address it, so that the local governments create an assessment and banks then do a secondary assessment and they eventually lend. This obviously does not solve the problem of, political economy of local government officials and banks sort of working together and property developers working together. But it creates a certain visible risk for these guys to engage in corruption. Because let's say if these projects are to fail, even after bank lending, or if they are remain incomplete or the developer collapses and so on and so forth, it is easier for the central government to pick on people, ascribe blame, and then create villains. So it's easy to direct public anger in that direction as opposed to as a government as a whole. So there's a win-win in that sense that is taking place. But this is currently the mechanism that they're talking about.
Ha, Manoj, and I thought corruption, non-performing assets and property crisis was a triangle unique to India. Does the bank then take liability if the project still fails? I mean, the bank can then probably not go to the government and say that please recoup our losses.
Yeah, so ideally that's the case, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the guideline of these whitelists quite clearly says that banks must conduct their independent assessments. So that, firstly, that tells you a little bit about how much faith central leadership has in local leadership, that they are saying that banks must do their own sort of market assessments. It also places that onus on the bank, that if, say, a project fails, it goes on the bank's books and it is a bad debt that the bank has to carry. And there is no escaping from that. And these banks know that at the end of the day, even though they may be state-funded and state-owned, there is a certain corporate responsibility that they have to fulfill because, I keep saying this, like in democracies like ours, with a banking system like ours, if a bank fails, a person loses their job, or a person eventually, if there is corruption, whatever, the person might go to prison or whatever. But that is in very select, rare cases. In that sort of a system, you not only you lose your job, you lose your entire career, you potentially are prosecuted, and that prosecution is political. So that you'll be part of a network. So it's quite a big risk to take. So therefore, there is going to be significant reluctance across banks to try and fund these 5,300 projects that have been approved. I mean, if you just look at 5,300 projects and 17 billion right now sanctioned money has to still come. There is a lot more to go. There is a lot more to go. And whether that will happen or not, we'll have to wait and see. But this is the method that Beijing is using. It's trying to essentially carry out, again, a bad analogy, but it's trying to essentially carry out a controlled explosion instead of a complete collapse. To make sure that the transition of the capital essentially transitions away from property towards manufacturing. But like I said, in the process, it is going to, I mean, it's not sufficient, right? I mean, I was reading an IMF report on the Chinese real estate sector recently. And they said that, look, you can do this and it can work, but the challenge is that this will be insufficient. You also need to introduce market principles in housing prices. So housing prices, there's nothing being sold yet. Housing prices are falling at a very slow rate. I think I was checking month on month housing prices decline was some 0.45% or something like that, which is really very, very little, because most international investment banks and all, Goldman Sachs and all will say that adjustments need to be to the order of magnitude of 15 to 20% in value. But that is politically very damaging because you end up immediately eroding a lot of the wealth of the middle class, which, to be honest, as much as China has eradicated absolute poverty, the middle class is not a massively rich middle class. You just need to go back a couple of years ago and you will hear the late Chinese Premier Li Keqiang saying that, look, nearly 400 million people in China earn just above sort of a certain level of income. They can't afford rent and, housing in cities. So it's not like China has become super rich and I think that is now coming to roost, right? You're seeing the deflationary trend that's hit the market. And that's because people are anxious about spending because employment has been a challenge. Holding on to job stability has been a challenge. And at the same time, you are watching your wealth erode. So it's going to be difficult to do this, but this is what I think the course that the Xi Jinping administration has adopted, and they look like they will be sticking through with this. So if anybody is thinking that tomorrow the leadership is going to back off because suddenly they're going to feel the pinch of this crisis because one developer fails or a bank sort of collapses, it's not really going to be the case. And that's what they're signaling.
Cool. So I have two then overview questions for you. One is, now do you see, so you said that there was already excess inventory with a lot of developers. Do you now see developers also switching to building more manufacturing centers, maybe more commercial centers rather than residential units? And the second question is, do you also expect the, so if the banks actually pull off this role and everything gets vetted, and therefore there's a slowing of developing itself. Would that significantly impact the Chinese economy in the long run? Maybe slowly, gradually, but do you think that might also happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll take your second question first. That is already happening. Hmm. You are seeing, so data for the last, just the quarter three and quarter four of 2023 tells you that historically, like I said, Chinese property sector contributes to nearly 25 to 30% of the GDP. Since around 2022 onwards, its contribution to GDP growth has been negative. So it's not really raising GDP. And at the same time, property and land sales have been a huge part of local government revenues, right? So essentially, local government revenues come from very select sources. The tax that they collect, they eventually send to the central government. But certain areas, particularly land, has been the land sales, deed tax, property tax, VAT on land, a land use tax. Those kinds of things have been key parts of local government finances. That has begun to slump. So which means that local governments become much more dependent on central government transfers, and which means that they have to then therefore abide by central government guidelines much more. So the autonomy goes away. So that sort of economic structure overall is beginning to change quite dramatically. Apart from just political control of the central government, you've also got greater financial control. And with that financial control, you can also dictate. And this is what the administration has been doing, is that while we are giving you X amount of money, this money must be only used for ABC purposes. If it is used for anything else, you can face disciplinary investigations. And therefore, you have central investigators come and check where the money is going. So that entire economic structure shift is already taking place. And the relevance of the property sector to the overall growth is starting to sort of decline. In terms of whether developers will be moving towards, say, other kinds of investments, perhaps I think that what you are likely to see is that they're likely to take projects which are much more favorable to the central leaderships, even within their core domains, which is, say, building construction. They're likely to look at projects which are, on urban renewal. So, old communities which need redevelopment, historical preservation.
Manoj, I'm from Mumbai. I understand redevelopment very well.
Exactly. things like where you have cheaper but rental housing as opposed to these grand sort of facilities and things like that. So I think that's where the money is being guided at present. Mm. And I think that's where developers who've got sort of core competencies will likely move into. In terms of manufacturing, I think the focus where the money is going is much more in upgrading manufacturing facilities, getting in new technology, which may not be the core competency of a property construction guy.
Right.
So therefore, they may struggle.
Right. But I wonder, how after a major earthquake, you usually see these construction of earthquake-proof buildings. I wonder whether now you are starting a pandemic-proof society.
I'm not sure. Pandemic, at least, like, say, I mean, the Chinese government anticipates, and evidently climate change is doing this. You're seeing lots more, disasters of higher intensity. So last year was massive flooding across the country. So you will see a lot of, developers looking at rebuilding communities as these things happen. So yes, I think that is our building disaster resistant, resilient sort of infrastructure.
Yeah.
So I think that, yes, that is a growth opportunity. I agree.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Okay. Manoj, do you have anything else that you wanted to add?
No, I think that this is, it's a really interesting space. And I think that the implications for what is happening in China are important for the world. But I think that one thing that people must, they're important from an Indian property market point of view, Indian capital markets point of view. But I think that one thing that we must keep in mind is that, and you often hear this fallacy, particularly not just in Indian media, but even in Western press. But I will speak of Indian media because lots of journalists from India have contacted me asking the same question. Whenever something around Evergrande or Country Garden or something like that happens, they'll ask me, is this China's Lehman moment? And I kept telling them there is a reason why there is no Lehman Brothers in China. And because the system is not the same, the system is not financialized like the American system was at that point of time, or even today is. The system is essentially controlled by the government. So if tomorrow the central leadership feels that it needs to act immediately, it can infuse liquidity with ease. It can block information. It can stop the sort of panic from spreading. It can do all of that. And therefore, a Lehman comparison is completely flawed. But yes, the fact that the government is doing what it's doing to try and bail out as much as possible through these different whitelists and whatever, is essentially tells you that the property market remains a sore spot from the point of view of social stability and political legitimacy through social stability. So they will keep acting, but they're trying to act in a way where you don't perpetuate the moral hazard that existed, which is, again, very different from what happened 15 years ago with Lehman Brothers and so on and so forth. So I think that comparison, if I can once and for all sort of wish away from people's mind, that would be great. So I hope if people can take that away from this conversation, I would feel that this is a success.
Thank you, Manoj. Thank you for sharing your very insightful analysis of the ongoing property crisis in China. Thank you to all the listeners for listening, and do tune in for another episode of All Things Policy.
Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach Podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.